This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. How much do incentives offered to companies to locate or expand their operations help create jobs? Tim Bardick, senior economist for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, spends a lot of his time trying to figure that out. His latest report is called Who Benefits from Economic Development Incentives? Tim Bardick, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
The last time you were in, we were discussing a previous report on economic incentives being targeted when they actually tip a decision one way or another for a company locating. How is this focus a little bit different? Are you now looking at what happens once that company locates? Who gets the benefit of those jobs?
Right. This report is looking at what are the benefits and cost of these incentives in terms of higher or, for that matter, lower incomes of state residents and local residents. We devote a lot of money to these incentives. They cost over $40 billion a year. It's about what states collect in corporate income tax revenue. And the relevant issue is, are the incomes of state residents any higher as a result? And what the report really tries to focus on is not just the sticker price of incentives, the $40 billion, but also what an economist would call the opportunity cost of incentives, which means that $40 billion is not a free lunch. There's no fairy godmother or Bill Gates who is paying for what a state devotes to incentives. Someone in the state is paying that $40 billion, either higher taxes on someone or lower spending on some public service. And there are economic consequences of those higher taxes and lower spending that must be taken into account in doing a full benefit cost accounting of these incentive programs.
So is there a way that you have seen that makes sense where you can structure incentives in such a way that those costs are worth what you get in return in terms of economic development?
Well, there are two guidelines. One, you need to really target these incentives so that you limit the ones that go to firms which have a low multiplier effect or a relatively low wage. And by a multiplier effect, I don't mean anything magic. I simply mean that one rationale potentially for these incentives is you incent one firm and it has local suppliers perhaps in the same state or same metropolitan area. In addition, the workers at the firm, if they're paid enough, will go out and buy a lot of local goods. So there are these multiplier effects. I mean, they typically might be 2, 2.5, maybe 3. That means that for every one job you incent, you might get, when you say a multiplier of 2, you mean for every one job you incent, you get one other job, total of 2. If you can get multipliers of 4 or 5 or 6, these things can definitely pay off. The other issue is how you pay for them. And one of the things this study really emphasizes is that if you pay for incentives by cutting back on productive services such as education, that's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea because one of the key things that drives long-term economic growth in an area is the skills of your workforce. Now, this doesn't affect things immediately. You cut back on education, say, of kindergartners, they're not going to the workforce at age 5. So there's not an immediate huge economic loss. But down the road, when people are entering their prime earnings years, a lot of those folks, that's your future workforce. If you're not investing in it, the economic development cost of cutting back on education vastly exceed the short-term economic boost you might get from attracting a firm today. So you have to be very careful about not only how you structure these incentives up front and targeting them in a careful way, but also about how you pay for them. What services are you cutting back? And if you're cutting back productive services, you're in big trouble.
So are you better off then if you are developing some sort of economic development program to say, if we're going to offer tax incentives to this company to move them in, we are going to raise taxes on other companies in order to pay for it?
Well, in some cases, it actually can pay off. One of the more surprising things about this study was that I found that actually in terms of alternatives for financing the incentives, one of the better alternatives is raising taxes in other businesses. And that may seem odd because, after all, the whole rationale for these incentives is that costs matter, and it might seem strange to say, how on earth can it pay off to lower taxes on some business and raise taxes on others? Well, the basic idea is that your tax incentives lower taxes on businesses that sell their goods and services to a national market that are what regional economists call export-based businesses or tradable industries. They're industries that trade not just with foreign countries but around the U.S. They're bringing new dollars into your economy, and they have multiplier effects. And we know that such companies have choices about where to locate, whether they're going to locate in this state or in some nearby state. They're selling to a national market. They have choices. They're more sensitive to taxes than businesses that sell locally. I mean, if you look at, say, fast food restaurant employment, that's largely driven not by taxes. It's driven by what's the total number of people living in the area and what's their income. It's not going to be driven by the taxes that fast food restaurant, on the margin. Obviously, at some extreme, it would be driven by taxes. But, you know, within a reasonable range of tax rates, that's not what's driving the number of jobs in fast food restaurants. But on the other hand, for so-called export-based companies that sell to a national market, taxes are a more important factor. And these are also, you're targeting companies that are making investment decisions in the here and now, whereas there are a fair number of companies that are just kind of going along and they're not really thinking about new investment decisions at a given point in time. The other factor is that this report is very much focused on what are the effects on state residents of incentive policies. And when you raise tax on other businesses, you're exporting some of your tax burden to out-of-state residents who generally, you know, most, you know, companies are owned by stockholders. Stockholders live all over the U.S. or, for that matter, all over the world. And so there are some advantages to exporting some of your tax burden. I'm not saying you want to take this to an extreme and say that, you know, we want to offer these huge tax incentives and just raise business taxes very, very high. But on the margin, if we cut back on these incentive programs, you know, if we did feel that we wanted to finance these programs in a better way, rather than cutting education, I think you'd be a little bit better off raising overall business taxes slightly.
So when you think about opportunity costs, as you say here, for a state or for a local government, and you think about if we're going to offer incentives, then we either have to cut services or we have to raise taxes. Does it get harder when you think of these incentives that way to justify some of the large dollar amounts we have heard for trying to lure Foxconn, Amazon, et cetera?
Right. Well, it's very hard to justify those. I mean, the Foxconn offer in Wisconsin is $4.5 billion in incentives for one company. It is 13,000 jobs, but it's one company. And the incentive offer you're talking about is roughly 8 to 10 times what typical incentives are in the U.S. per job, 8 to 10 times per job. And Amazon, similarly, Maryland the other day was revealed their incentive offer for Amazon is over $8 billion. Now, that's for 50,000 jobs, a huge number of jobs, but still the amount per job that's been offered to Amazon by Maryland is extraordinarily high. That's really hard to justify in terms of a hard-headed benefit cost analysis of either project. Will Foxconn yield $4.5 billion of benefits to state residents in Wisconsin? I think that's very doubtful. Even if you assume that without the incentive, there was zero chance that they would have chosen Wisconsin, even if you assume that, you have to look at the fact that not only will if Foxconn creates jobs, that will also bring in additional people, which will mean additional needs for public services that need to be taken into account of. There's going to be additional infrastructure costs. There's going to be, you have to build new schools, hire additional teachers. If you want to keep the response time for police and fire about the same, you got to hire additional police and firemen. So there are all these different costs. And of course, not all the jobs actually raise state resident standard of living. If a lot of people move in, and we know that when jobs are created, that a lot of the jobs create population growth, and they don't raise the employment to population ratio. In terms of how easy it is for you to get a job, the ultimate variable is the ratio of employment to population in the local area. And you know, Foxconn will raise the employment to population ratio somewhat. But it will not, because additional people will come in, it will not raise it as much as you might think. So when you do a hard-headed analysis, it's very difficult to see how this pays off. Now, how is Wisconsin going to pay for Foxconn? Who knows? And the other aspect of this, both with Foxconn and Amazon, is you know, it'd be one thing if these were one-off offers that, and sometimes company people try to claim that, that they're just going to offer this to one company. But in Wisconsin recently, they announced that they would give a similar deal per job to Kimberly-Clark for job retention purposes. The company was saying they might have to close down some operations. And then they offered, said, well, some other companies they'd offer a similar deal to. Amazon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase said, well, any state that offered a lot of money to Amazon, he would ask for a similar deal for J.P. Morgan Chase. And what would be the rationale for saying no? I mean, you might have a rationale for saying, okay, you're creating, Amazon's creating 50,000 jobs, you're creating, you know, 50 jobs, we're going to offer you a lot less because it's fewer jobs. But what's the rationale for offering one company a lot more per job than another company? You have to, it's very hard to politically or economically support differential treatment per job. So, you know, one of the concerns about this whole competition is that it might be getting out of control, that with Amazon and Foxconn, we could easily see the $40 billion or, you know, in subsidies, incentives, whatever you want to call them, we currently offer double over the next 5 years.
So when you look at who benefits from some sort of economic incentive that we assume actually does tip the balance, as we say, and brings a company in or creates an expansion, is it likely to be people at the lower end of the income scale, the upper end of the income scale, somewhere in between?
It depends crucially on how you finance it. If you finance it through increased taxes, and if the multiplier effects are high enough, then in fact, the benefits tend to be somewhat progressive. They tend to benefit groups all across the income spectrum. And as a percentage of income, people on the lower end of the income spectrum would tend to do somewhat better. They would tend to do somewhat better because if you really do have high multiplier effects, you've really targeted this, the increases in the employment to population ratio benefit most the people who are most likely to be unemployed. And that tends to be people on the lower end of the income spectrum. On the other hand, if you finance these incentives by cutting back on education significantly, one of the public services that does the most to help equalize the income distribution, obviously it doesn't totally equalize it, even if that were feasible, but it does help quite a bit, is public education, which delivers benefits to a wide variety of income groups. And so from the viewpoint of low-income folks, working-class folks, providing incentives to companies and financing by cutting back an educational service that will help their kids succeed long-term in the labor market makes absolutely no sense. And in fact, in some of the estimates I do in this report, I find that you can have an economic development incentive program that might pay off overall for all income groups. But if it's financed by cutting back on education, it would seriously hurt people in the lowest income groups.
Is there a way to structure incentives so that you're more likely to provide jobs to people who already live in a given area as opposed to creating jobs that bring people in who move there to take a job?
Yes, there is. If what you need to do is combine incentives with job training and job placement policies that do a better job of linking residents of the local area with available jobs. So we have a variety of job training agencies across the U.S. I guess I should mention, as a matter of disclosure, that the Upton Institute, where I work, I'm in the research division, but the operations division of the Upton Institute runs the local, is the administrative agent for the local workforce programs in the Kalamazoo area. Michigan Works. They run Michigan Works for Kalamazoo and three other surrounding counties, including Calhoun County. You know, generally, these programs around the U.S. Exist. If they're strengthened and play a stronger role, if successful, what they do is they help local residents who aren't employed have a better chance of getting the available jobs. And from the viewpoint of promoting economic development and making it benefit local residents more, that's what you want. When new jobs are created, you want local residents who are non-employed to get those, have a good chance of getting those jobs. Obviously, you're also going to have some jobs go to in-migrants to the area. No one's arguing you shouldn't have any in-migrants to an area. You need that as part of a healthy economy as well. But if you're trying to maximize the benefits in terms of per capita income, per capita earnings of state residents, the more jobs you can get for local residents who are not employed, and if you structure your job training program so they're strong, so that they're trusted by employers, so employers are willing to use them for referrals, if you have strong job training components so that you know, obviously, in order to hire the local non-employed, they have to have the skills needed by employers. In many cases, that will require good training programs. It may also require good support services. Some people, you may need to do some follow-up services to help people keep the jobs. Because, oftentimes there are different reasons why people aren't employed that you need to help overcome various issues they may have that may vary from transportation to childcare to other issues. The other thing you can do to help more local residents has to do with how states structure these programs. If they structure the programs so that more of the incentives are provided in areas with higher unemployment, one thing we do know is that when jobs are created in the local economy, if the unemployment rate is high, more of the jobs will go to the unemployed. If the unemployment rate is low, then the jobs tend to go to in-migrants, which makes sense. I mean, basically, when new jobs are created, employers look around for who's available. If the unemployment rate is high, there are a lot of local folks available. If the unemployment rate is low, then that has to lead to in-migration.
One thing that you suggest in this report is that governments who offer these incentives might consider front-loading them. In other words, putting all the incentives up front as opposed to stretching them out over a number of years. What's the benefit of that?
Well, a couple benefits from front-loading. One benefit is we have a lot of studies of how businesses make investment decisions, make location decisions. And given the way the stock market works today and given the pressure on business executives to meet quarterly profit targets, there's a lot of focus on the short term. It's very unlikely that a tax abatement, property tax abatement, in year 11 of your investment plays any role whatsoever in location decisions. So why on earth are you offering it? Well, there are some political reasons for offering it. Namely, there are some advantages to a state politician, a legislator or a governor or a local politician, a mayor or a city council, of giving away your successor's tax base. Then it'll be your successor's problem to deal with the revenue thing. So there's some reasons why people do it. Those aren't good reasons. Those are good political reasons, not good economic reasons. So the reason for front-loading is it probably has a higher bang for the buck. You affect location decisions at a lower fiscal cost. Now, you do have the problem if you give incentives up front. What if the company leaves after 3 years or whatever? And so then you have what are called clawback agreements, which can be written in as legally enforceable agreements that you basically say, we're providing you this incentive today in exchange for which you agree to provide so many jobs for the next 10 years. And if you leave after 5 years, we prorate it or whatever. And so you can work out the exact provisions of that. So there are big advantages. The other aspect I think about it is this is one way of providing a budget constraint on these incentives too. If they're provided up front, then you have to pay for it immediately. Forcing governors and mayors to pay for these incentive programs immediately, I think, has some advantageous political. It forces a reality check. Can we really afford these programs? Giving away your tax base 15 years from now, there's no reality check today. You're just creating problems long term, and later on, people have to deal with it.
If you are offering incentives now, and as you say, front-loading them, so you're doing it up front, and to follow something else you say in the report, you are getting that money by raising taxes on other businesses. Is it then the case that politically you're going to be more open to the charge that we often hear that politicians are picking winners and losers amongst competing companies?
Well, if I were actually structuring, if I could just design these programs myself, I would just structure these programs as general, pretty much rule-based programs that for any company making an investment and job creation decision that is an export-based company, that's a tradable goods company, I would offer a similar incentive per job. So I wouldn't pick winners and losers. I would pretty much offer a similar incentive. I might also vary it with the predicted multiplier effect of the incentive, but I would try to very much have a rule-based program where every company meets certain criteria and making investment and job creation decisions would get the same incentive per job. And I actually think that's my advice to states when considering things like Amazon and Foxconn. Whatever rules you currently have for awarding incentives, apply them the same way to a Foxconn or an Amazon and simply inform Amazon that you have a set of incentive programs. You provide certain property tax relief for 3 years and you provide certain investment tax credits and job creation tax credits for the first 3 or 4 years. And, you know, this is what you get. You get the same amount per job as some other company, and that's the deal. So I would not pick winners and losers. Now, you know, I might pick winners and losers in the sense of if we get beyond tax incentives to services, I think that needs to be more customized. But in terms of tax incentives, I would simply have rules for what you provide that would be followed for every company in the same exact way.
Are there other incentives that you would also want to offer? You mentioned something in the report about, for instance, customized job training. Is this, when you're talking politically, does that have the same cachet as a tax credit or a tax incentive, a tax abatement? You know, does it have the same ring politically that that you would get out of saying we're going to, you know, give somebody a tax break?
Well,
to move here.
No, unfortunately it does, because it doesn't get the same kind of publicity. And I think the public is more interested, you know, for whatever reason. There's a lot, you know, $4.5 billion for Foxconn or $8 billion for Amazon attracts a lot of attention from the public. It attracts a lot of attention from the news media. I mean, I get lots of phone calls from reporters asking me about Foxconn or Amazon.
But if somebody were starting
this is
job
actually
training,
one of the few times reporters asked me about customized job training. So you're distinguishing yourself here and asking about it. I think there's a lot of evidence that these services, particularly services to small and medium-sized businesses, locally owned businesses, can be quite effective. In other words, you offer customized job training. The idea is you're offering a service that costs the government X dollars to provide. And the service might be more valuable than that to the company. It might be worth Y dollars. You're giving them, particularly if it's a smaller company, they may not have the resources to offer the kind of job training they'd really like to offer their employees, may not have the expertise in how to run job training programs. And if they work closely with a local community college, they can set up a program that has a higher bang for the buck than simply handing out tax incentives. And it can make a big difference to a company's competitiveness. And there are a number of studies that have looked at this that find this, that in some cases they find that, say, customized job training might have an effectiveness to cost ratio of 10 to 1, that it's 10 times more effective than handing out tax incentives per dollar. You find similar things for the manufacturing extension services, which is works with small and medium-sized manufacturers. The name is modeled after the Agricultural Extension Service, which people may be familiar with, that have since the 1930s have worked with smaller farmers, helped them improve their farming techniques. But in this case, you work with manufacturers and you provide them essentially with some free or relatively low-cost consulting services on how to find new markets, how to improve the efficiency of their production line, how to manage their human resources more effectively. And again, there are studies showing that manufacturing extension may have an effectiveness to cost ratio far more than $1 of effectiveness per dollar of cost, in some cases up to $10 of effectiveness per dollar of cost. So potentially, this is something you can say to areas that are saying, okay, so I'm saying to some extent, let's cut back on tax incentives, make them more targeted. And the question is, what do you replace them with? Well, you probably at a much lower cost could help small and medium-sized businesses in your local economy with some of these services. And I would go beyond that to say things like small business development centers, business incubators, customized things like that. Entrepreneurial training, where you work with a group of people who want to start a business and help them be more successful in starting a business or potentially in some cases talk them out of losing their shirt. That can be a useful form of entrepreneurial training
to convince
people not to start a business that's going to fail. But I think these services can be very effective in helping build up your local small business sector. You know, there are different models of how to achieve prosperity in your local economy. Trying to attract the big fish is one model, the Amazons and Foxconns of the world. trying to build up your skills is another model. And trying to grow your local small business sector is still a third model. I think in economic development, we need to have a balance between those different approaches to how to build up prosperity in your local economy.
When it comes to building skills, is the assumption that someone might be making here that they think if they attract a large company, then skilled workers are going to want to work there. So therefore, they'll move from somewhere else, and that developing the skills from within isn't as necessary. But from a business standpoint, are you looking at it and saying, hey, we want to move somewhere where we know the skilled workers already exist?
But whose industry are we trying to advance? I have nothing against people moving in, but how exactly does people moving in who have skills help you if you're a state resident? Now there's some help. I mean, people moving in create demand. Maybe it results in some additional, there will be more trendy restaurants, more brew pubs, if people moving in. And so it creates certain services that might exist because of a critical mass of demand moves in. So I'm not diminishing that there are some spillover benefits of more skilled workers moving in. On the other hand, the benefits of building your own skills in your own residence, it seems to me that's a more immediate, more tangible, and much larger benefit from residents. I mean, I'm not saying you don't want to attract skills from without, but building skills within clearly has a very high payoff for residents of a state or a metropolitan area.
One of the things you say in your report is that there are short-term political barriers in place here to doing economic development the way that you prescribe. Is that always going to be the case, that it's if you are the governor of a state and you watch the governor of another state offer a big incentive and they get to do the ribbon cutting, that's going to affect your decision making?
Well, it is. I mean, I don't know what to say except that I think the public, the news media, different interest groups have to try to resist the lure of the short term and debate the long term. We always need to be talking about not just, we need to try to the extent we can to allow people to focus on the big picture and the long term. We need to say, look, attracting this firm today might provide some jobs right now, but if we're paying for this by reducing our investment in education, that's going to have major costs 20 years down the road. We have to think about our kids, our grandkids, and what kind of local economy and local society and local community we're leaving them with. And if you say, well, look, we live in the short term, we have to survive now and get jobs now. Well, yes. So I'm not saying you totally eliminate tax incentives. If you target them on the highest multiplier firms and the highest wage firms, you limit their costs and maximize their benefits. And if you invest in customized services to small and medium-sized businesses, if you help your local manufacturers become more competitive through manufacturing extension, if you work with local small businesses and help them expand, you provide some customized job training, you can provide some immediate benefits and job creation at a cheaper cost. So, I'm not saying you don't do anything in the short term, but you need to be very careful in financing and paying for the short term that you're not sacrificing your long-term future.
Tim Bardick is senior economist for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. His latest report, Who Benefits from Economic Development Incentives, can be found at upjohn.org. You can also find a link to that report at wmuk.org. Tim Bardick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.